But the stupidity starts at the top, and then we all get it. We all sort of get it by osmosis. I used to think that people were responsible for their leaders. I don't anymore. And so it's totally unjust, ludicrous, and overgeneralized to suggest that it's victims and victimizers. What I take off against increasingly is governments.
I remember I.F. Stone, who you know, once described governments as comprised entirely of liars and nothing they say should ever be believed.
Quite right. And Tolstoy once said, governments are a collection of men who do violence to the rest of us. Between Izzy Stone and Tolstoy, you've got it about right, it seems to me. They're all bad and some are worse.
Welcome, fellow lovers of liberty, to the Allison Bricker Show. I am, of course, your host. Thanks so much for tuning in to the broadcast. Have an excellent show lined up for us today. I'm going to be joined here shortly by the one and only Sheldon Richman. He is, of course, the vice president of the Future of Freedom Foundation, and he is the editor of FFF's monthly journal, Future of Freedom. For 15 years, he was also the editor of The Freeman, which, interesting story, actually received that in the mail once, and my mother was worried that this was way back in the 90s. I had completed an Advocates for Self-Government quiz and somehow ended up receiving the Freeman Journal. And I remember my mom, she was concerned that we were going to be added to some sort of watch list because it was, you know, belligerent. This was in the days before September 11th, but, you know, hey. But nevertheless, Sheldon is an excellent author, and I'm really excited to be able to speak with him this evening. He's agreed graciously to be interviewed because I'm really kind of interested. He wrote an article, as we talk about a lot on this show, voting. And you may have seen that John Stewart of The Daily Show had spoken about how he had not voted during an interview on CNN with Christine Amanpour, and then he had to retract later on that night, or maybe it was the day after, on his show, The Daily Show. And really, it's just incredible that culture at this moment in a post 9/11 world, that the sham of voting is like some sort of almighty religious institution and has really become close to what communion almost. If you're not a good citizen, if you are not voting, et cetera, et cetera. So it'll be interesting. I'm not a fan of voting. I stopped voting after 2008. I wrote in Thomas Jefferson because Ron Paul wasn't even on the ballot. And that was the last time that I voted. Sheldon will be joining me probably about 7 after the hour, little give or take a minute or two. I also want to remind you that beginning on December 1st, my show will be going, the Allison Bricker Show, will be going live Monday through Friday. That's right, 5 days a week, ladies and gentlemen. I'll be on the airwaves, spreading my brand of domestic belligerence against an illegitimate U.S. government. But I'm going to be over at libertytalk.fm. My show will be heard there Monday through Friday following the Scott Horton Show. So that'll be 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern. And, of course, you'll be able to get the on-demand podcast as well. So if you're a fan of the show or you are looking for a particular excellent interview, because that show will focus more so on interviews, because honestly, it's one of the greatest parts of being able to do a radio show in this internet age, free from FCC licenses, is that I get to speak with some of the most brilliant people in the liberty movement. And really, to me, the fascination with talk radio has always centered around the big conversation. Being able to talk with other individuals and exchange ideas and how we can get more free, or, you know, whether it's just what the government is doing the most in its most recent incarnation, whatever policy decision it may be issuing on high from the District of Criminals, or just to a general philosophical aspect of how do we obtain more liberty in our lifetimes. I have been blessed to speak with many of the brightest minds, and Sheldon's going to be coming up here very, very shortly. But that's what I want to concentrate the show on, basically, is talking with great individuals, those who have solutions, right, outside of relying upon the state to provide us liberty, ways that we can obtain our liberty all by ourselves, whether it's just completely circumventing the system, nullifying it, or as we spoke with Dan Johnson a couple weeks ago of Panda, getting local governments to interpose against your tyrannical federal government. You know, it's not perfect, but no solution is, but we can be more free. I see that Sheldon is calling in on the line. So, Sheldon Richmond, thanks so much for joining the Allison Bricker Show. That you had recently written an article over Reason, which is a website I honestly don't check as often as I should. Are you writing there regularly now?
Well, they pick up my stuff that originates with the Future Freedom Foundation. So my TGIF column on Fridays, and then I have one other article during the week, and they are consistently running those. So I'm not writing them special for Reason.
Oh, okay. Excellent. That's, I guess I just ended up seeing that from Reason, and that was regarding the Jon Stewart fiasco, where he said he did not vote on CNN and then had to retract that same evening.
Right.
And when I was reading the article and the poll quotes that you put into the article, it really sounded like someone from the State Department possibly drafted that.
I don't know. I wouldn't know. I hate to think that he was taking, orders from the State Department, but it's, you know, not the first time that he's had to crawl back after saying something that at least some people thought was too edgy. I mean, what he said was not very edgy. He was asked by Christiane Amanpour on CNN if he had voted because they were speaking on election day. And he said, no, I just moved and I don't know where my thing is, meaning his polls, the polling place. That's not an irreverent statement. It's not like he said, oh, what's the point of voting? It's useless. Of course, that would be a true statement. But he didn't say that. He just said, I just moved. I don't know where the polling place is. And she acted or pretended to be, scandalized by that. She said, no, you haven't voted. So it was a buzz for several hours. And they talked about it on CNN that day and then even the next day. And then that night on his program, he came on and said, I shouldn't have kidded about this. It's too serious. I shouldn't be flip, which I thought was totally ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. I don't know, how much have you ever studied Edward Bernays at all in regards to his relationship to democracy?
Yeah, I'm a little bit familiar with Edward Bernays. Yes, he's considered the founder of public relations, isn't he?
Right, yeah, he was the nephew, I believe, of Freud, who, you know, from my understanding, yeah. Freud absolutely, basically, he hated regular people, could not stand them, thought we were all animals that needed some sort of caging. But Bernays was instrumental in, like, the whole, like, making the world safe for democracy with Wilson and when it comes to voting and this religion where God is government, I can't get past whether or not it's just another marketing shtick.
Right. Well, they certainly do use the methods of marketing. Noam Chomsky some years ago wrote a book called Manufacturing Consent. So he also shares our analysis of that. It's a very self-conscious idea to get people to be what they regard as good citizens. That means going to the polls each time and constantly hammering us with the view that every vote counts. But of course, that doesn't stand up to simple arithmetic. If you're voting in any kind of sizable jurisdiction, you know, maybe some little tiny small town, this is not exactly true. But in any sizable jurisdiction, the chances of a tie are very small, and therefore the chances of any one vote determining the winner are very small. Gordon Tullock, the great economist, who unfortunately just died recently, great public choice economist, one of the founders of public choice, would like to say that you had better chance of getting killed on the way to the polls than in determining the outcome, making a difference in the election. But they don't want us to be thinking that that the vote doesn't make any difference, doesn't, you know, that your vote doesn't make a difference. No. So they have to constantly tell us, no, they all count. But how can they all count? I mean, I did vote this year because I had a particular reason, but I didn't vote from 1980 until this year. And I guarantee you not one election that I lived through that I could have voted in would have been any different had I voted. I know this for an absolute fact because none of them were ties. So I couldn't have been the tiebreaker.
Right. Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you, here in the state of Indiana this year, they spent money on commercials talking about where there was a tie back in the 19th century. And that's why all the way there was one election they could point out, I believe, in the middle of the 19th century that they then said, well, this is why you have to vote, because one vote does make a difference. And I guess to me, I don't vote anymore simply because I don't, not so much that I don't believe it has an effect of an outcome. I have a problem with universal suffrage, where those with no property get to vote for people who promise to take more of our property away. Has that ever been a consideration for one of the reasons you don't vote?
No. Because unfortunately, too many people with property vote in people that loot the rest of us. So that doesn't really make a
difference. No, well, that's definitely worth the consideration. Yeah, I can absolutely understand that one as well.
I stopped voting because I always felt like I really needed a really good shower afterwards. I just felt dirty. and so, you know, you said there was a tie in the 19th century. Yeah, sure. I'm sure some of there was a tie. But of course, I don't know what office that was for. Congressional districts are a lot larger now. I think the average district is something like 300,000 people. So the chance of a tie in a jurisdiction of 300,000 people is pretty small. And therefore, you know, I guess the people that vote also buy lottery tickets because their chances of affecting the outcome are similar to winning the lottery. I think there's a better chance of getting hit by lightning or hit by an asteroid even, or a meteorite. So, you know, I guess these people are living, apply the same principle to all kinds of things in life. And actually, you know, I'm being sarcastic here because they don't. They only apply it to voting. A lot of people who vote if you said, well, buy a lottery ticket, would probably say, I'd never buy a lottery ticket. The chances are too small. So why do you vote? And here's the other thing. And I draw on the great works of Brian Kaplan, The Myth of the Rational Voter, which I recommend to your readers. It's a very good, your listeners, very good book. He points out that, and other people have pointed this out too, that voting, you know, you have your one vote, which is not going to be decisive and really doesn't cost you anything except for the time and the, you know, driving to the polls if that's what you want to do. But otherwise, you're encouraged to be a totally irresponsible voter. There's no incentive to be an informed citizen, right? If your vote's not going to make any difference, why would you spend time really studying up? I mean, honestly studying up, not just looking at the website of the person you already like. I mean, really. And first of all, you would need to study economics to be a good voter, wouldn't you? Because so much of what candidates promise to do is about affecting the economy. Take the minimum wage. Lots of candidates said, I'll raise the minimum wage if elected. Well, how am I supposed to judge that unless I know something about economics? How many people know something about economics? Very few. So they're not good voters. They can't be informed voters. They have to take good classes, and I mean Austrian economics. They have to take good economics, not just any economics, not Keynesian economics, in order to be good voters. But how many are going to do that? Why would they? Their vote's not going to affect the outcome. Why would they spend money studying economics just so they can cast a more informed vote? It doesn't make any sense. It encourages irresponsibility. That's what the system does.
Right, and it really does, as Bastiat said, it encourages plunder of the system because we end up electing the worst people get elected to office that are there for no other reason other than to take from everybody.
Right, and campaigning is the art of deception. It's right. Campaigning is theater, and so it rewards people who are good at creating a mood, right, at pushing the right buttons, getting people to feel, you know, good about you. It bears no relation to the truth. Or what they may even do in office, or how intelligent the person is, or how much that person knows about economics. They just need to create a good mood among voters. So voters say, oh, that person's trustworthy. I like that person. I'll go and vote for that person. That's what gets rewarded in politics for the most part. Look, there are some exceptions. Obviously, there have been a few good people. Unfortunately, we can count them on one hand. But for the most part, you're going to get basically showman types, right? You're going to get shysters. You're going to get frauds. Who are good at fooling the people. P.T. Barnum's basically get elected to office for the most part. And that's what that's what people vote for, because they don't need to know anything about issues. They right. just have to have a sense that, oh, yeah, I like that person. I like what that person says. That person confirms my own biases, so I'll vote for that person.
Right, absolutely. It makes me feel good. This person makes me feel good. And I think the right. 44th puppet-in-chief that's currently occupying the White House is a prime example of someone who gave really beautiful, large, visionary speeches and actually right. has turned out to be even worse, could you imagine, than George W. Bush. I mean, this guy has executed Americans. George Bush was torturing foreigners. But we now have a president who gave really awesome speeches as opposed to President Bush's bumbling speeches. But this guy is killing not only, you know, all the brown people in the Middle East, but he's also killing American citizens. I mean, so right. there you have it.
That's right. And he was a great mood setter in 2007 and 8. That's right. One reason he was able to defeat Hillary Clinton was she's not very good at that. It's going to be interesting to see how she does in 2016 if she decides to run. But I don't believe she's very good at setting that mood. Her husband was pretty good at setting a mood. Right.
Right. He was awesome. Yeah. He was excellent.
He would look you in the eye, they say, and probably even on television, and make you feel like you're the most important person in the world. I don't think she can do that. I don't think she has those political skills. We'll see. I mean, I could be wrong. The fact that, you know, she could be the first woman president could sway a lot of people who might not have voted for her otherwise. But those are the skills that get rewarded, right? These theatrical skills. It has nothing to do with what you know. You don't need to know anything about economics. And yet most of what politicians do affect the economy. So,
well, now most of what politicians do negatively affects the economy.
Right. Exactly right. And so to be an intelligent voter, even if you thought your one vote could make a difference, would mean a serious study of economics. And, you know, like I said, I mean largely Austrian economics, but certainly sound free market policy, so that I can know that when someone promises to raise the minimum wage, I know that person wants to put, maybe not wants to put, but will put unskilled workers out of work. You need to know some economics to know that. Most people don't know that. Look, the minimum wage passed on the ballot in a couple of states, including the state I'm in, Arkansas, and, you know, by large margins. None of those people could tell you why that's a good thing. They just think, oh, well, of course I want to help low-income people. They're just making themselves feel good, like you said.
Right, yeah. Well, and the absurdity of the entire electoral process, at least from a national perspective, this factors into my refusal to vote as well. I mean, it's been it's been 20 years since I graduated from high school, but my freshman year, there was a Bush and a Clinton on the ballot. And there is the absolute opportunity that we could see a Bush and a Clinton on the ballot again. And I mean,
you can feel like you're back in high school.
No, but I don't want to. I'm glad I'm not in high school anymore. I couldn't stand it. But I mean, we have become like this dynastic, imperial, crumbling empire. And I think nothing portends that more than the fact that we've got two retread families that are going to possibly be on the presidential tickets.
Hey, and someday it's going to be George P. Bush in Texas versus Chelsea Clinton.
That sounds like a nightmare. God. Well, now you talked about Stewart having basically lacking a spine and, you know, cowering back and retracting his statement that, oh, I did a bad thing. I shouldn't joke about the sincere institution of voting. But we didn't always have comedians who were so scared, right, that actually stood up and said, no, I don't bother voting.
You couldn't imagine George Carlin apologizing for anything. And the irony is that Carlin is said to be Stewart's hero. And yet he doesn't deserve to have, you know, their names shouldn't be in the same sentence. Carlin was a true satirist, a true social, funny social critic, a true comedian. A friend of mine, Ryan Calhoun, wrote a very good article at the Center for Stateless Society site pointing out that if George Carlin was a comedian and in the sense of a biting, funny social critic, Stewart is a court jester, or what they used to call a fool in the sense of being a court jester. In other words, he could go in before the king and kind of make fun of the regime and the crown. But he knew the limits, right? As long as he was entertaining the king, it was okay. If he stepped over a line, he could get his head chopped off. Well, Stewart's the same way. Notice what he does. I mean, I used another example, which I think is even more telling. A few years ago, He referred to Harry Truman when he was in discussion with a neocon on his show. He referred to Harry Truman as a war criminal. Now, Harry Truman killed hundreds of thousands of people dropping A-bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. That's a war crime. Those were civilian areas. Those people were not even in the military, and they were not threatening Americans or American troops. And yet he did that. That's the definition of a war criminal. But a couple of days later, Stewart said that it was a stupid remark, and of course he's not a war criminal, and he apologizes. He didn't explain. He didn't explain what was wrong with his initial statement, which also wasn't a satirical statement. That was just a truthful statement. Truman was a war criminal. That's not a funny line. But he took it back, and he never explained why. And, you know, we don't know the reason why. We don't know whether the executives at Comedy Central said, hey, this is too hot to handle, take this back, or whether someone else did, or whether he just decided on his own. But this is a pattern. He's done some good things. He can be funny, and he's ventured occasionally into some dangerous areas like Israel and the Middle East. I give him credit for that. But, you know, when it comes to something like you can't joke about voting or you got to apologize for calling Truman a war criminal, you know, that's not the sign of somebody who idolizes George Carlin.
Right. Absolutely. Because George Carlin didn't apologize for anything. And he was, you know, I don't even think of him as a comedian. The guy was just a really he was our generation's Mark Twain. I mean, he was just so brilliant and prophetic on the way that he could just completely dissect any sort of issue. I've watched some of his stand-ups back when America first invaded Iraq in 1991 under Desert Storm or Shield or whichever one that was under the previous Bush, Herbert Walker Bush. And he was there was no wrap yourself in the flag post 9/11 kind of mentality there. He was already ripping into the notion of killing this, you know, that's all America was good at anymore. It was war. And I don't remember the outrage against him. In fact, he was then later invited to the Washington, D.C. press club.
Right. And if somebody demanded that he apologize, he would double down. He wouldn't apologize.
Right. Absolutely. He would have flipped them the bird and said and then done a whole setup on them. We're coming up to the bottom of the hour news. But I wanted to ask you before we get there, do you think that this sort of dearth that we have in political satire or the willingness to go past that line of institutional, I don't know what the word would be, it has to do with post 9/11 that we are no longer the land of the free, home of the brave?
Yeah, we're not even the land of the sense of humor. I think it does have something to do with 9/11. I mean, I haven't tried to trace this historically, so I couldn't tell you know, what the state of American satire was before 9/11, but I think that does have a lot to do with it. But it's not a very good excuse. I mean, we've had great social satirists who were stand-up comedians. We had Lenny Bruce. We had Dick Gregory, who's still around. And there are a few others. And occasionally you see some of that in John Oliver. And, you know, I'll stop there because it's a very short list.
Right. Well, John Oliver is new, right? I mean, he's basically an immigrant over from England. I don't know how long he's been doing. I know he was with the Daily Show, but...
Yes.
He comes from a different kind of perspective, right? He comes from a British background.
Well, Britain's had some very good biting political humor. There was a show some years ago in the 80s during the Reagan and Thatcher years called Spitting Image.
Oh, I loved it. They showed it on NBC after the Cosby Show when I was little. I loved it. That's had right. It on VHS tape. I absolutely adored it.
They were those great caricature puppets of major political figures. I remember so much of it being about Thatcher and Reagan. And it was great. I remember thinking at the time, why doesn't America have this kind of satire? This was an import from England. And I was asking myself at the time why there's nothing like that originating from the United States on television.
Absolutely. We are speaking with Sheldon Richman of the Future of Freedom Foundation. You're listening to the Alison Bricker Show. We're coming up to the bottom of the hour news. We'll be right back with Sheldon Richman.
tuned in to the first round-the-clock live talk radio station in history, TruthBeToldMedia.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Alison Bricker Show. Thanks so much for sticking around to the bottom of the hour news. We are speaking with Sheldon Richman of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Sheldon, are you still there with us?
I'm still with you.
Excellent. Now, you know, I thought of one thing during the bottom of the hour news. On Saturday Night Live, they used to show these, like, cartoonish sketches. I believe they were called TV Funhouse, and I remember reading shortly after September 11th that I can't remember the guy who actually did them, but they were pretty biting. They had like the ex-presidents were one of, they had five of the ex-presidents were superheroes, but they were just complete bunglers. That guy had gone over the line, and those sketches had been pulled right after September 11th. And so that's really the last time that I can remember SNL actually trying to go into that water as well. There really is no outlet for biting political humor. I mean, Doug Stanhope, he's a stand-up comedian. He gets in there sometimes and says some really controversial things, but he doesn't have a platform like Stewart, and he's not been invited to SNL.
Yeah, that's a good point. I've heard a lot about Doug Stanhope. My son is a big fan of his. I don't think I've seen anything of his even on the internet, so I should be looking him up. But I've heard good things about him. So yeah, obviously there are a lot of people around, and many of whom I'm not familiar with. So I can't say nobody's doing it. But you're right. There's nobody very prominent doing it the way it used to be done. I mean, like I said, in the league of Carlin or Lenny Bruce or Dick Gregory, or, you know, there's a whole group of people. You know, in the 50s and the 60s into the 70s and 80s, and, you know, even a little bit beyond that. But it's an honorable profession historically. I mean, there were 19th century, you mentioned Mark Twain. There was, W.S. Gilbert and Sullivan in Victorian England. You could go way back on almost any era. There were biting satirists who weren't just making fun of particular figures. That's pretty easy to do, and they do that on Saturday Night Live. But I'm talking about humor that really gets at the root of things, that questions the legitimacy of what happens day to day at the hand of the government. That's the dangerous area that people, you know, they either stay away from it altogether or they don't even understand that there's something there to be mocked. Right. They're not radical enough to even know that.
Right. They don't even realize that we're living in a totalitarian tyranny. Yeah. I mean, people are still just fine. And now people are totally fine with the notion that blue gloves stick their hands down your pants to, you know, anytime you want to travel in this country. And that's, I guess, completely acceptable. So that may be the actual problem, that people don't realize anymore that this is not what a free country looks like. And you know, you have the First Amendment. You're born with the natural right to criticize your government. You should use it.
Yep. Yeah. You know, the humor today is more suggesting, the political humor is more suggesting that, you know, something has gone too far. But it's very rarely a fundamental root, you know, criticism through humor. It's just that, oh, this is going a little too far. Like, oh, the TSA goes too far. They should, you know, not do that. They should be pulled back a bit. That's kind of the nature of it, right? It's more a matter of degree. They never really go at the, you know, the thing itself, the very root principle of the thing itself. Because I don't think, first of all, they don't have a radical analysis, even just privately for themselves. I don't think so. So they're not going to, it's not going to occur to them to make fun at such a fundamental level, because they don't even, you know, they wouldn't even think of it. To them, the system's okay. It may have a few abuses here and there. and we can make fun of the people that, you know, that say silly things. But otherwise, yeah, they don't want to touch it.
Right. We can fix this tyranny. We can reform the tyranny to be a softer tyranny.
Yeah.
Now, I want to ask you, do you think, does a political cartoonist, do they also qualify as a satirist?
Well, I guess some of them would. You're right. I don't keep up with them. That's also an honorable profession, and I'm sure there's some good ones out there that maybe I just don't see because they're, you know, I'm not looking at a lot of newspapers. Even when I look at papers online, I don't look to see whether the editorial cartoons are there. There have been some good. I would count those as political satirists. Certainly the best of them.
Right on. Yeah, I used to collect when I would go to antique stores. I like Puck. He was like late 19th century, I believe, early 20th century. Harper's kind of New Yorker. He had some really, I mean, those political cartoons were, again, they were not just poking fun at a gaffe of a politician. They were poking criticism at the root of an institution, whether it was corruption or graft or whatever. And the cartoons that I see today in the Sunday papers, not the funny section, the actual ones that are supposed to be the political commentary are, again, just they poke fun at something that somebody, the way somebody speaks or something that they say, but nothing of substance.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the problem. That's what's missing. But that has great potential. I mean, I wish I could draw because I'd get an idea, but I can't execute it.
Right. We need a patron, you know, and I wonder if this is such an interesting concept as to why are we not seeing it? Because there are some out there like Doug Stano, but again, he's not getting access. And I can't help but think that it has something to do with the consolidation of media through the FCC scam of licensing, that we are very, very, very close to five companies. That's, you can count them on one hand, that will own all of the licenses to everything you read, see, and hear.
Of course, we have the internet. I mean, you can. Bill Hicks has done some really good things, funny things.
Absolutely.
Sort of what I'm talking about. Again, I'm not familiar with his work to a very large extent. That's something else I need to address. But you know, we have the internet. We have YouTube, so you can find these people on there and pass it around to your friends or post it on Facebook. So we can do what. What isn't being done. In other words, find the good people and then spread it around ourselves, spread their work around.
Well, absolutely. And that's kind of my point, that we're where the traditional old medias have now, we're down to five companies. I think it's interesting this week. I'm sure you heard President Obama came out in support of net neutrality, which is eerily similar to when they came out for public safety as the reason to license the airwaves. And any government that executes citizens and says that it can put you in a cage without a trial or any evidence is the last arbiter of neutrality I could imagine anyone could accept.
Right. Yeah, I put on Facebook, anybody who is favoring net neutrality has way too much faith in the state.
Absolutely.
What and do they think? The state is some sort of neutral arbiter? It's not.
Exactly. I mean, what's wrong with the internet now? It seems to be working just awesome. It seems to be blossoming. We're running a radio station without an FCC license. I get to speak to people like Sheldon Richmond, these excellent thinkers. What's wrong with the internet at its current state?
Right. And there, you know, where there are issues, they relate to things like this. A lot of ISPs have virtual monopolies in certain towns and cities because of the public utility arrangement, right? So cable, if you have cable modem, cable access to the internet, cable companies are monopolies. Now, there in some places you can get around that because there are other services that have found a way, you know, to avoid sort of the traditional delivery or the traditional service. But the government has been involved in public utilities for so long that it's not a pure market system. But I see what you're getting at. We certainly don't want to make it any worse, even if it's through noble sounding, you know, principles like net neutrality.
Absolutely. We know. And I have to say, I mean, I look at the cell phone market, whether it was 3G and now it's 4G and then 4G LTE, the market is working. And fortunately, I do live in an area where I don't have to rely on one of the massive cable companies. But there's also people like Elon Musk from Tesla. Who he's talking about satellite internet, and not the slow kind of dial-up version of satellite internet, but the guy that created Tesla Motors, he's now talking about bringing ubiquitous satellite speeds to the internet. And so it may not be instantaneous. You may not be able to go and get your internet off the value menu if you live somewhere rural in the moment, but I think the market is, while it may be slower, it will, in the end, of course, deliver the much superior result to the bureaucrats who will try to, constrict the internet in order. And really, they're only doing it. I mean, to me, the regulatory state exists solely to help the big companies block out the little guys from ever coming up to challenge them.
No, that's true. And we have to watch how the established firms will attempt to squelch innovation, which is a way to get around those firms. And we have an example with that company. I think it was called Aereo.
Yes. The Supreme Court decision.
Which was going to be able to send signals that are going through the air and then channel them to your home so that you could select only the channels you want. It was very cheap. It was a little antenna. It was the size of a coin that you plugged in. And you could have an a la carte menu of instead of having to buy one big block of channels when you're not going to watch 90% of them and save a lot of money. Well, what happened? Well, the big companies like ABC and NBC, they took this guy to court, this little company to court, and claimed a copyright violation. They said, hey, these are performances that we put in the air, into the air, and they're not allowed to, you're not allowed to represent them somehow to your customers. That seemed like bogus.
It's totally absurd, isn't it? It's totally absurd.
But the Supreme Court backed the entrenched interest in this, that company's out of business. So it's true that people like Tesla and others can come along with great innovations that'll get around these dinosaurs. But with intellectual property and other legal devices, they could end up striking back. The umpire strikes back, in other words, and put these innovators out of business. So we have to hope the courts won't go for it.
Absolutely. And that kind of leads me to your latest article. But I wanted to say, to me, the Aereo decision is the government speaking out of both sides of its mouth, because this IP notion has become like a nuclear weapon of the white collar, crushing the resistance. To me, if you've got FCC licensing and it was under the guise of public airwaves, which means we all own it, so no one owns it. And if I could, in the old days, just put an antenna on top of my house and intercept these performances, I don't see what Aereo was doing was any really different than, because I was renting, I could have rented an antenna from Aereo and just then received it through IP, internet protocol, not intellectual property. So I don't understand. The government is talking out of both sides of its mouth here. I mean, if you're licensing these broadcasters because it's the public airwaves, you then can't claim I own all of the public airwaves.
Right. And of course, that was a theory that Herbert Hoover and others in the 20s launched and imposed on the American people. The airways were actually being developed and homesteaded by individual innovators back in the early days. And the government jumped in with Herbert Hoover was the Secretary of Commerce at the time, and said, hey, we need to do something about this. This is evolving spontaneously, in other words, the way free markets do it. And he thought, no, we don't want it to evolve spontaneously. We want the government to oversee it. This is the great Herbert Hoover, supposed to be an advocate of laissez-faire, which, of course, he never was. And so that was the beginning of this idea that the people generally own the airways rather than they're an asset that's homesteaded through somebody's innovation and, development. In other words, figuring out how to broadcast a signal over it. But anyway, that's a long history.
Right, absolutely. Do you know that they used the sinking of the Titanic as one of the reasons to step into and govern? They said, all these small broadcasters were clouding the broadcast airwaves, and therefore the Titanic's radio signals could never have reached, the appropriate authorities. Therefore, we have to issue licenses to make sure that there's always clear bands for emergency broadcast.
I see. Yeah, they always have some reason.
They always have some sort of excuse, and it's always some sort of calamity that they have to step in and be Superman, which, you know, it's like it's the evil version of Superman. Sure. But speaking of stifling innovation, your latest article I saw over at the Future of Freedom Foundation is on Uber, which is kind of an innovation, right? A competitive innovation to chauffeurs or traveling, right?
Yes, very good segue there, because there is a lot in common. Uber, and there's another company called Lyft that does the same thing, developed an app which you can use on your smartphone. You need a ride to get from point A to point B. You launch this app after you've signed up, and they have a way to contact you. You then say, I'm at place A, I need to get to place B. They find you. They then dispatch or they match you up with a driver. In other words, they don't have a fleet of cars. They don't employ drivers. What they do is match up people that want rides with drivers. Now, they've recruited drivers. They've screened them, right? They've vetted them. They make sure they don't have criminal records or something. You're able to reach one of these people through their app, and they tell you what the rate will be, how much it'll cost you, how long it will take them to get to you, and then when the ride is over, they ask both rider and driver to rate each other. So and those ratings are then viewable by the users. Well, of course, this is upsetting the taxi cab drivers, who are in this country are all licensed. And in any significant town or city, the number of cabs is limited by the number of licenses. But these people are getting around all that and coming in, and it's upsetting the regulators. It's upsetting the drivers, and it's the cab drivers, and it's upsetting the progressives, who have been screaming bloody murder about this, about how, of course, we have to regulate Uber. How dare Uber just come into a town and begin to do business without getting the permission of the officials? It's really creating quite a storm.
It is, and I think it's just another, because I remember reading an article not that long ago that medallions, in which the taxi cab license in New York City, they were in excess of like $50,000 or some ungodly price.
Oh, I think it's much more than that. It's like upward to $1 million.
$1 million.
They don't make them anymore. Unlike the money system where they put unlimited quantities. No, medallions are a fixed number. In fact, there were fewer medallions now, or there were in 2012, is the latest figure I saw. Fewer in 2012 than there were in the late 1930s in New York City.
See, and that's what it is, right? That is what we have become. We have become this country, when I say we, has become a corporate fascism. I mean, it's all about protecting these rackets from any... It's a good thing this wasn't so in place back during the 19th century, because I think we'd all still be having horse and buggy and candles. I mean, God forbid we have those evil light bulbs come in and change the entire the way that people light their homes. This mentality of trying to stifle innovation is one of... Just, is there any other explanation other than a tyrannical regime?
Well, when people get entrenched through government power, and that's the only way to get entrenched. You can't entrench yourself in a free, really free market. You need government power. So once you do that, once you've spent money to get your little niche nicely protected by the state, of course you don't want someone to innovate and come in and upset that, right? You've made an investment. You're now getting monopoly returns because of your privileged position and your protected position. So if Uber comes in and, without having to make that sort of investment in the political system, begins to satisfy consumers and make money, where are you left, right? They're not going to want your service. And what about all your investment in your political position? So you can see why they get upset. It doesn't justify it, but you can see why they're upset.
Right. Well, yeah, all their capital expenditures are now, they can't depreciate them and write them off on their tax returns anymore, because, well, they're now worthless because there's a better, more efficient service. Are you familiar with any cities or towns that are already banning? I know Indianapolis is, those taxi cab drivers here in the Circle City, they were outraged at how dare these private individuals do it. Is Los Angeles or Boston, anybody else banned them?
I've read that Austin and Miami have barred Uber, and that the whole Commonwealth of Virginia has, I guess it's operating in Virginia, there's a request for a cease and desist order In Little Rock, Arkansas, where near where I live, the company came in while discussions were going on with the regulators about how to have a new what new regulations would be written. But Uber decided to start up the operation anyway, and so there was talk of injunction. I have not read that they that anyone has asked for an injunction, but there was talk about it. So yeah, that's happening everywhere. In some places, like in London and Boston, I think there have actually been traffic jams caused by the taxi drivers to protest this. In Paris, the Paris council or government passed a law saying there had to be a mandatory 15-minute delay between the time a user, a rider, makes a call or orders a ride over the app and the time that the person will be picked up, a mandatory 15-minute delay to level the playing field. Now, luckily, a court in France disallowed that, but that's what they tried to do. They said, wait a second, we need a level playing field. Uber shouldn't be allowed to respond so quickly.
Right on. That's the government, right? Making service worse. And if we have to, we'll force you to make it even less efficient and worse service. That is government to a T, and it's God.
Well, it reminds me of the great Kurt Vonnegut story, Harrison Bergeron, which talk about satire, satirized this idea of enforced egalitarianism. And in this nightmare world that Vonnegut portrayed, you know, anybody that could run faster than anybody else had to wear weights around his ankles. And anybody that could, anybody that had any kind of talent that wasn't generally possessed had to be handicapped in order to level the playing field. And it's the same thing. They had to handicap Uber, or at least Paris tried to handicap Uber because it was responding more quickly than the monopoly, the taxi cab company.
Well, and that's the thing that I think that seems to be lost on people a lot of time when we hear these buzzwords like equality. Well, it's not necessarily a higher bar. Oftentimes it's a much lower bar that they're bringing the rest of us all down to. And I think, boy, that goes full circle to the minimum wage, right? I mean, it brings those who are above minimum wage, their spending power is lessened. And the same thing here with Uber. You know, oh, well, they're too efficient, so we have to make them wait 15 minutes. And you see the same thing, this restriction on competition with, again, Tesla, where they're being banned from selling their automobiles directly in several states.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And that's a dangerous idea because that's state protectionism. You know, people usually think of free trade and protection in terms of, national, the nation state, national boundaries, but not between states. So for Michigan to say we're not going to allow any, out of state or out of country car to come into our state is really taking protectionism another step. I mean, it's bad enough when it's at the national level. But to start doing it at the state level, why not do it at the city level, right? Why should something made in New York City, why shouldn't they put up a barrier to keep that a similar product made in some other American city out? I mean, in fact, Alexander Hamilton in the Federalist Papers, when he was arguing that the Constitution should be ratified, and of course the Anti-Federalists were arguing against it, Hamilton said that if the Constitution is ratified, the tariff could be tripled. I mean, he says this, I think it's number 12, Federalist Papers. People can check it out. He actually argued that the tariff could be much higher. It was very low against foreign goods, again, not other American.
Right, not domestic.
Not domestic, but against, European goods mainly. And he claimed it could be tripled if we had the Constitution. So this idea of the Constitution was intended and in fact accomplished to create a free trade zone is more mythology than history.
Interesting. Well, I will tell you this much: we do have protectionism here in the state of Indiana. On Sundays, one of the core reasons they cite every legislative session is that liquor sales are banned on Sundays is that it keeps out the big box stores from putting out the mom and pops, the small mom and pop liquor stores. And I see that as a form of protectionism. In fact, there was an editorial in the newspaper as how important it is to preserve the local liquor store.
We have some similar things going on here in Arkansas because we have some dry counties. A lot of them are dry. And there was a question on the ballot just last election that would have made all counties wet. In other words, they could have package stores, liquor stores, and it lost badly. And the argument, the main argument against passing this was that it would destroy local power, local decision making. In other words, why should all other counties tell County X that it has to allow liquor stores? And I wrote an article in response to that, which said that, which was called Nothing is More Local Than the Individual. So if we really care about individual decision making, we shouldn't be looking at town or county, the county level. We should be looking at the individual level. And if I want to open a liquor store and you want to come and buy, you know, buy stuff from it, nobody should interfere. That's the most local decision making of all.
So, Sheldon, before I let you go here, what's your next article? What are you working on? How can people stay in touch with you? Are you a Facebooker, or Twitter, or?
I'm on Facebook. You can find me on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at Sheldon Richman. I write two articles a week at the Future of Freedom Foundation site. They can find an op-ed style, kind of a short one that we also send to newspapers early in the week. And then every Friday is my TGIF column. Those are reprinted on Reason, so that you can catch them there. But come to fff.org and have a look. And my upcoming article for tomorrow will be about, I call it free market socialism. I'll just leave the title there to entice people so they can check it out.
Ooh, that's excellent. I wanted to actually talk about that. Well, good. Well, that's a reason to have you back on the show again.
I'll come back on.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining the Allison Bricker Show, Sheldon. I look forward to reading your article tomorrow and having you back on here in the future.
Thanks, Allison. Great to talk to you again.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye, you too.
Bye-bye.